The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call State and Local Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections to order. Representative Kahn, you have the first bill before us, House File 653.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess I would like to move that House File 653 be recommended to pass, and I believe go to the General Register.
All right.
And the this arose from a problem that occurred when cities like Minneapolis, I saw it happening in Minneapolis, so let me speak about Minneapolis, but it does deal with other cities too. When they switched from two-year terms to four-year terms, and then suddenly they're having an election in 01, and the election in 01 is being carried out on the district lines that were in 90. Now, that's not too bad. St. Paul's not going to have a city election for their four-year term till 03. But what's happening is that they're running in the old lines. The new lines exist, but they haven't been able to redistrict into them. And they're not going to run in the new districts until 05. They're not going to take office until 06. So that means we're not going to have equal representation in the wards throughout the city until 06. Besides that, there were several people, including me, who ended up not having a council member living in our ward. So I tried to take this to court with the assistance of Professor Schultz, who is going to be testifying here today. And with a lot of machinations, we went from federal court to state court and back to federal court and lost. And the reason we lost, the kind of one-line reason why we lost, is although state law requires redistricting immediately after the census, it doesn't require an election. And the implication that redistrict, the reason why you redistrict is to use it in a new election, didn't carry. The court essentially said if the legislature wants to change the law, they can. So let me bring Professor Schultz, who needs to get off to a class, who's here. And then also Joe Mansky. As I said, this affects St. Paul, mainly in the next election. And Joe Mansky has written an amendment to make it work for St. Paul. And the League of Cities likes the Mansky Amendment and so forth. So we'll be
all right.
able
welcome,
to go.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Sure, of course. My name is David Shelton, professor at Hamline University, where I teach election law. And, of course, just want to mention I'm representing myself and not speaking on behalf of Hamline University. And what the bill seeks to address today, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is I think is a peculiar oddity in Minnesota election law that really, I think, affects just cities in the state of Minnesota, and more specifically, cities that have four-year terms and elect their entire council all at the same time, as opposed to staggered terms. And what we see is a situation, as Representative Kahn described, is that it occurs, I think, roughly every other decade for cities such as Minneapolis, St. Paul, I think Duluth, and maybe a couple of other cities, but I can't remember on this, where because of having the four-year terms, they may have elections that come immediately right after the census is done. And what you have is sort of a strange scenario that I can describe what happened in Minneapolis. Is that in Minneapolis, in 1990, we had the census done. In about 1992, I think you had the new district lines drawn, elections occurred. And then in 2000, you had a new census. 2001, you had, I think, the new district lines drawn. But then you had elections in 2001 based upon the old census data and old lines from the 1990s. And so we have a situation to where essentially what happens is that individuals who are elected as council members, we create some odd scenarios where they are elected from one set of district lines, but then while they're serving in office, essentially the district lines are shifting to reflect the new lines being drawn for the next election. And what that winds up creating is an incentive in some situations for representatives to move, or to start thinking about representing new constituents as opposed to some of the older constituents. And as Representative Kahn pointed out, we saw in Minneapolis back in early in 2000 that there were a couple of districts that either were underrepresented or were without representation. Cities in Minnesota are the only body, as far as I can tell, that do not have to truncate their terms, four-year terms, after a census. Under state law, the Minnesota Senate has to, in some situations, run a two-year term to comply with redistricting, and county commissioners in the state also have to truncate their terms. City council members don't have to truncate their terms. And so what we're trying to do here with this bill is to say essentially that when you have this once every other decade problem, that also city councils and cities in the state of Minnesota would have to have a shortened two-year term or some other variation so that you don't have the representation significantly out of whack. And just to give you a sense of how out of whack it might be, is that we have a scenario here to where you potentially have an additional 3 years where individuals in Minneapolis or in St. Paul where the district lines might not conform to the census. And so you have a pretty significant period of time here where the district lines do not match necessarily where the representatives are. And so, again, hopefully this bill will correct this problem. And I should also mention that what the Minnesota Supreme Court and the federal court said was essentially that while this is not a violation of either the state or federal constitutions, they didn't discount that this, in fact, was a problem, but said that it was something better left to the representative bodies to address. Thank you.
All right. Representative Kahn, you had one more person.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'd like to move the amendment, the A2 amendment. And then I would like to have...
Representative Kahn, I think you want to move the A1 first. I believe the A1 is the one we want to move first, and the A2 would be if the A1 is adopted.
No, let me... Okay. Thanks.
So, yes. Representative Kahn, you're moving the A1 amendment?
Yes.
All right, then... Do you want Mr. Manske to speak to the... Is this Mr. Manske's amendment?
Yes.
Is Mr. Manske?
Well, perhaps since Mr. Schultz has to leave for his class, I don't know if he has to leave quite this fast, but if there are questions for him, I guess I'd prefer to have him available to answer.
President Kahn, I didn't see any questions of Mr. Schultz. I'm sorry, President Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schultz, in regard to this, the percentage of deviation in redistricting in congressional, state, local elections, being that this is a local election, does this change in any way the requirements for deviation between these election districts? I mean, how are you going to deal with that? Because you do have other state law that requires that, and it's probably a 10% deviation, isn't it, right now, thereabouts?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Total.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, yes, for local state local elections, representatives, it's up to a 10% deviation. And I don't think we're looking at any of the law being affected by the deviation here. What we're more looking at is not percentage of deviation, but I would call it sort of duration of deviation. How long can you go between redistricting and keep certain representatives in office?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it does pose an issue for us because when you're dealing with this, I've never heard of changing the duration of deviation. It's usually been quite specific, but there's that window of opportunity, and I don't want to be creating a new status of law of duration.
Okay. Mr. Schultz, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mark, I probably said something that was confusing, and I apologize. We're not changing deviation in terms of the percentage, but what we're referring to here when I said duration, it seems that what we're doing is giving cities about 3 years additional time beyond what we would give either for the Minnesota Senate or for county commissioners to hold elections, to be able to come into compliance with the most recent redistricting. And that's what I was referring to. So again, I misspoke.
All right, members, the motion before us is the A1 amendment. Mr. Schultz, do you have anything else to say to the A1 amendment?
No, I do not.
With that, let's get Mr. Manske. Is this your amendment? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and then to the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Mansky. I'm the Ramsey County Election Manager, and this is my amendment, or this is Representative Kahn's amendment, actually.
Well, Mr. Mansky, it's Representative Kahn, but you're going to explain it for her.
That I am. And just to be very succinct, Mr. Chairman, the issue for a small number of cities, St. Paul being one of them, is that our city council runs in alternate years from our mayor. And I think our preference is to remain that way. Under the bill as it was originally written, it would require our council to have elections in three consecutive years, in 2011, 2013, 2015, which does not make a whole lot of sense. So given the technology that, Mr. Chairman, you know from personal experience is now available to us, we are actually able to do the ward plans very rapidly. And I think, as you recall from 8 years ago, we received the block data from the Census Bureau on March 29th, 2001. At that point, we are then able to create the ward plan and, for that matter, the congressional and legislative district plans. And my thought is that rather than wait and have this series of elections, it would be better just to do the ward plan immediately. Hopefully, if the legislature completes its plan, but if not, in the interim, and then with the idea that once the legislative plan is adopted, that it would be possible for the cities to make some minor boundary adjustments so that we don't end up with some very odd-looking and very small precincts.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And then I believe there's an A2 amendment. Mr. Mansky, the A2 amendment is necessary now that we've adopted the A1 amendment, so would you like to explain the A2 amendment?
Oh.
And Ms. Rushen, okay. Why don't you move the A2 amendment?
I'll move the A2 amendment.
All right. Mr. Mansky, Rushen, you want to explain it?
I'll move the A2 amendment, and I'll allow Matt, I'll ask Matt Guerin to explain it to me.
All right, Mr. Guerin.
I think I can, but I'd rather have him do it.
That would be my preference, too. Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment is a technical correction to the A1 amendment. It's basically specifying that in a municipality that adopts a redistricting plan in a year ending in one, that plan is effective in the year ending in one. Otherwise, the default effective date would not be until the next year under current law. So this is specifying that once the municipality adopts their year ending in one, redistricting plan is effective immediately.
To the A2 amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kahn, to your bill as amended.
Well, the bill is in shape. I would like it passed. It was the problem that I got into when I tried to do this in 02 and 03 was that we were just too late. This gives ample people opportunity to know that what they're going to have to do. In the handout that I gave you, one of the things that I hoped for, the last page of the handout that I passed out showed what happened 10 years before that with Bloomington, when Bloomington had the same situation coming up. And there, somebody threatened, as I thought I was going to be able to do, someone threatened to sue to have an election, and Bloomington just completely their charter. They just totally changed their charter, and they went to the same system as the Minnesota Senate has with the two-year election when it's necessary, and then the four-year election. And I'd hoped that that's what Minneapolis would do, but they weren't as afraid of me as the people were in Bloomington, so we didn't get that done. So this fixes the problem. This census for St. Paul and for Duluth and for any other cities that may have that problem, and it fixes it for Minneapolis 20 years out.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Kahn, I hope you can expound on the statement that you just made. It looks like Bloomington was able, with their charter, to take care of this issue. However, apparently Minneapolis didn't see it as that big of an issue, and so they chose not to change it. Why would we then, the whole purpose of charter status is to allow the people in that municipality to make their own decisions. Why would we as a legislature want to trump the decisions of the elected officials within the city that we're speaking of?
Representative Khan.
Mr. Chairman, particularly with the what I'd call the Mansky Amendment on it, this takes care of it for all of the cities. And it's, you know, I believe there's no objection from any of them, and we should just do that. The Minneapolis Charter Commission actually did pass the proposal, but the City Council didn't even hear the Charter Commission's recommendation. So it's just, this is a basic aspect of democracy, and it's just fixing up a crook in state law that needs to be fixed. We caused the problem. The state law, in a sense, causes the problem. We can't fix it without doing the Mansky Amendment in, because the state law... So one to explain that.
Mr. Mansky?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, Representative Khan is right, and I was, a co-conspirator in creating this scenario, that in preparation for the legislative redistricting, we do, in the state law, freeze the city's abilities to change either their ward boundaries or their precinct boundaries until the legislative plan has been adopted. But given our somewhat unfortunate track record in recent years and the need for some cities to deal with this ward issue right away, this kind of gets us down that path. It permits the cities to do essentially what you suggest, but it still leaves the precinct boundaries available for whoever is doing the legislative plan in 2011 and 2012 to do what they need to do.
Representative Biskin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'm hearing things running in circles. My question is pretty simple. Could the city of Minneapolis or any other city of the first class change their charter similarly to what Bloomington did to get rid of this whole issue without legislative authority?
Mr. Mansky?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, no.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Mansky, could you explain why?
Representative Biskins, because since the changes were made in this section prior to the 0102 redistricting, it removed the city's authorities to use their charter authority to deal with this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Mansky, can you give me a little timeline then? When did Bloomington make its change? When did the change in state law occur? And why are we, did Bloomington make, I'm still not getting it, and you know, it's early.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I'm not sure exactly when Bloomington's action occurred, but I will tell you that the changes in these laws occurred before the 0102 redistricting, and deliberately so that the legislative boundaries would exist before any new precinct and ward boundaries were created. The reason for that was to prevent the situation where a precinct would be divided between a legislative boundary, which was the case in the past. When the cities had the ability to do their ward and precinct boundaries first, we used to have a small number of precincts that were split by either a legislative district boundary or a congressional district boundary, and that was a subject that we wanted to deal with definitively, which the legislature did by enacting the statute in front of you, 204B.135.
Representative Kiffmeyer, did you have a question?
Yes, I do.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question I have is on Section 4, line 3.3 or so in that area. But it has to do with the procedure, making a boundary change. And the concern that I would have is, generally what I've always heard is more time to make these changes. Now here, you're reducing the time from 90 to 60 days time, and then for the general public, notice of the change posted in the office of the municipal clerk or county auditor, changing from 60 days to 42 days. Now, the 42 days affects the public, the 60 days affects your administrative process. Could you explain to me why you'd want your time reduced? And why this is a benefit to the public to have their time reduced.
Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Kiffmeyer, if I can call you that. The reason for changing these numbers is simply to make the schedule work in a year ending in one. Because if you follow along the schedule, typically the legislature these days always adjourns on the Monday following the third Saturday in May. Generally speaking, the reviser does the presentment of bills within 3 days after the legislature adjourns, which is why we have that June 1st date in there. That's a date by which the cities can then tell, has a legislative redistricting law been enacted? If that's not the case, then they have about 3 weeks to prepare a ward plan, but no later than 14 days before the first day to file for office. If you follow along with that schedule, 90 days before the next election is actually the middle of June, so it wouldn't be possible to do this and adopt the precinct boundary changes that would be necessary to implement the new ward plan. So that's the reason for pushing the adoption of the precinct boundaries a little closer to the first election, which for the cities that we're interested in would be their municipal primary in 2011.
Any further discussion? Seeing Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mansky, just I'm trying to understand the testimony that cities can't do this. When I go back and read, and I asked Mr. Gehring when this was enacted, it shows 97 or 99 it's been around. But it only provides that cities won't be able to do this. It takes away their authority in only two years.
That's right.
So they can do it at any other time. They've got 8 other years during a decade. And Representative Kahn is shaking her head no. So I must be mistaken. Could you explain to me why they can't do it, why cities can't do this during those 8 years?
Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, I mean, hypothetically, a city in the interim could do something like this, but you need the language that enables them to both move the ward boundaries and to make certain precinct boundary adjustments so that they can hold an election right away and more to the point before the legislature is redistricted. That's the really important element here.
Representative Emmer.
Well, Mr. Mansky, that's I show me, or if you could point me in the law where they would be frustrated, where a city would be precluded during that 8 years to set up their own precinct boundary. Well, we're not even talking about that. To do what the city of Bloomington did to change their charter. What would stop them from doing that during the 8 years that are not affected by the current law?
Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, nothing except that remember that they would not have the census data that they need to do the redistricting until we get to one of these years ending in one. Again, that's the real issue here. It's not that they have a mechanical inability to do something in the interim years, but this only becomes an issue after the census data is released, because that's when they become exposed to the equal protection challenges of not having a plan in place that is compliant with a one-person, one-vote requirement.
Further discussion? Representative Emmer?
No, I'm right. Really confused.
All right. Then Representative Kahn renews her motion that House File 653 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Kahn, your next bill is House File 655.
Okay, this bill is a little easier. I seem to get before the Supreme Court an awful lot of times on election issues. This next bill is a little bit easier, and we think it's just common sense. And the amendment, I would like to move the A2 amendment. The A2.
All right, Representative Kahn, you're moving the A2 amendment to House File 655.
Yes.
And this gets the bill in the shape you need it?
Yeah.
All right. Members, let's put the bill in the shape that the author requires. All those in favor of the A2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Representative Conn, to your bill as amended.
Okay, but this is something that all of us thought was actually true. We have a constitutional requirement for a candidate to live, a legislative candidate, or to live in their district for six months before the election. In the 02 election, but there's no requirement to put your address in any of the filing, in any of the filing forms. There's a place for address, and you think that means address, but it doesn't mean address. It just means any address that you can be reached at. And so my opponent in 02 had an address which I immediately saw was outside of the district, but I just assumed that that was his he wanted to use his campaign manager's address. When we found out, it was actually brought to our attention by this person, because I guess when he had moved, and when he registered to vote, he got his registration card saying that he lived in 59A, not 59B. So he then proceeded to write a letter asking how he could rectify this. Could he move back into the district? What could he possibly do about this? The Hennepin County elections official immediately said, no, there's no way you can rectify it. You've lived out of the district for 2 months. You can't live in the district. So we'll leave you on the primary ballot because we can't take you off, but we're taking you off the general ballot. He then wrote a letter of complaint, and there was immediately another letter saying that he had really intended to live in the district, and his intention to live in the district should have been enough to guarantee that he lived in the district. So we then had a case where the election official reversed it and said, we don't have any ability to judge attention, so you will be on the ballot unless someone says you could come off. So two plaintiffs living in my district sued to have him taken off the district, and we had to go to the Supreme Court, which decided without a dissenting vote that he did have to come off the district. In terms of what we're looking about, court costs and waste of money and so forth, it just seems that this is a really simple thing. I don't know, Mr. Mansky actually says it's amazing how often it happens, but I don't know how often it's likely. Usually what happens when you point out to someone that they've done this, they don't disagree and they're just taken off the ballot. It was weird that this person got to disagree. And so in the courts, though, of requiring names to be on the ballot, there are people who don't want their names on the ballot. And that's county attorneys, county sheriffs, judges, and so forth. Turns out there are also some legislators, because of having gotten threats to their person, also don't want their names on the ballot. So this amendment was worked out with all of these people. It's probably a bad precedent to say this, but in the course of the Senate hearing, and so I think all the people who had some problems with the bill now say it's fine with this amendment.
All right, rest in time. I had thought you had moved the bill earlier, but you did not. So let's withdraw the motion on the amendment, and now let's go to the motion on your bill, House File
655. I'll move that House File 655 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Yeah, because I think people need to know where the bill is going. Now, okay. Let's go to the A2 amendment
now,
which you've explained. So
I'll move the A2 amendment.
All right, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The opposed nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Now, to the bill as amended. Representative, or did you not want to speak? That's that member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Joe is still here. I think he's familiar with this case, so he can speak to it also.
I was going to ask Representative Conn, were you actually concerned that someone from outside of your district might have actually made a challenge to your ability to get elected within your district?
Well,
Representative Conn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was part of the problem, was I had to pay. When I asked, I thought that the caucus should pay for this. So I went and asked the caucus to pay for it. And their response was what Jim Rice used to say about buying a lottery ticket, was that this guy's chance of winning, what Jim Rice would say was that your chance of winning the lottery is about as good whether you buy a ticket or not. And the caucus's response was that this guy's chance of winning was about as good whether he was on the ballot or not. This kid actually got into a lot of trouble because he was my intern before he did this, and he ended up being he ended up being the subject of a column in the in a national publication, the ethicist in the New York Times magazine section. So he got into a lot of problems.
Representative, yes, I did want to talk. the question that I have is your amendment, or the amendment that has been voted on, refers to a candidate's address must be classified as private data. Could you explain, Representative Kahn, what that means?
So people who want to have their address kept kept secret for some reason or another. I've had a death threat, and I haven't felt it necessary to keep my address secret. But a senator who was speaking at that time had a rape threat and feels that she wants to keep her address secret and just keep it as close to
focus on the bill.
Well, that's the reason, is that there are people, plus attorneys, you know, some of the people in the law system.
Yeah, let me be more specific. And by the way, I managed to get one of those threats like yours too, but I have a feeling they came from two completely different people. I was talking about the legal meaning or definition, your legal meaning or definition of private data, because it says classified as private data.
Representative,
I think that just goes to the classification that it's the classification that we have of private data.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that's where I was going. Is the only classification I know is under Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act. And the question I have, then, is you've moved it to the General Register, but doesn't this have to go to civil justice?
Representative Kahn?
If that's considered to be the appropriate place, yes. I'm sorry, I'm not.
Well, I'll leave it to the chair and Representative Kahn, but if I'm not mistaken, we have a data practices subdivision that addresses exactly this issue.
All right, Mr. Gehring, you want to weigh in on this one? Apparently not. Representative Kahn.
I have no preference, Mr. Chairman.
I
really think it's a... what we in the old days used to call a consent calendar bill. I mean, we have a constitutional...
Representative Kahn, I doubt whether any election bill any longer a consent calendar bill, particularly one like this. So I don't think consent calendar is where you're going
to
go.
Mr. Chairman, I have no preference as to whether it goes to... If it goes to the General Register and someone will move it to... You know, I honestly don't care. Just if... people think the amendment should be amended to go to civil justice. I have no objection. I have no objection to that.
Well, Representative Kahn, apparently, looking at it now, it appears it may be an issue that was discussed last session in data practices. And since you've made that change, I think what we'll do is have you withdraw your initial motion, and then let's have a motion to send it to civil justice. So, as amended. So, Representative Kahn withdraws her motion, and House File 655 is amended, recommended to pass, and be re-referred to civil justice. That's the motion before us. Representative Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gehring, the amendment or the bill does not, as I read this, change any definition of residency. Is that correct?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that's correct.
And can you clarify for me, if I might, a follow-up question? Is it possible for someone to declare a residency in a property that they own but don't actually live there? Is that possible under current law or under this change?
Representative Gehring. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I believe under current law, your residence is the place where you stay permanently, which is different from a property that you own. but without checking to be sure, I'm not entirely confident of that.
Representative Ryan.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It would seem to me that the key issue here is that the person actually lives there, and if we're not clear about what the current rule is, then I think we need that clarified before this bill moves any further.
Representative Cox.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that that's been an issue, and this bill does nothing to change the current law on that issue. And I do believe that it is, and I think the Supreme Court decision was very clear that it, that the person had to have lived there, and that he could not just say that he intended to live in the district and he just made a mistake in living outside the district. Because he lived in the district, and then he moved out of the district on June 1st, and discovered in August that that was, that address was out of the district. And so he moved, and so he then moved back in. That was before he got the letter saying it didn't matter whether he moved back in. This guy incurred a lot of expenses, I think, in doing this. And then he, but it doesn't change anything in this.
Representative Lanning, Mr. Gearing has a reference for residents that may clarify it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, in Section 200.031, there's a list of factors that are used to determine whether something constitutes a residence for purposes of filing for elected office. And I can, it's paragraph A through M, so I can bring it down to you if you want to read all of them.
And this...
Representative Lanning.
Thank you. And this bill or amendment doesn't change any of that, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, the only other thing I'm thinking of in terms of somebody saying they don't want their residency listed, their address listed, is, yes, it's up to the filing officer to determine under this section of law whether or not they, in fact, meet the residency requirements, but as an element of transparency, the public being able to identify that, yes, this is the person's residence, I guess, well, I'd have a concern on that issue.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing in public law, there's nothing in law right now that allows that transparency. You can put an address, and it can be any address you want. I think if you look at the filings, judges do not put, I don't know what they put as contact, but they in general do not put their addresses on it. So it's in practice, it doesn't change anything that's in practice now, except it just puts the address only, oh, one of the interesting things we discovered in looking at this is that constitutional officers other than the governor and lieutenant governor don't even have to be residents of the state when they file, which is kind of interesting. If anyone wants to take another bill to deal with that. But the...
let's just focus on this.
I know. Okay. But the point is that this just gives a way to determine it so that we wouldn't have had this silly exchange of decisions in Hennepin County and then necessitate the Supreme Court having to make this decision at a time when we're trying to cut out judicial costs. I think we all agree. We've agreed with the residency requirements. We agree that they're reasonable. Now the point is, what do you do when they're being violated? And this gives you a simple way. My simplest way was to require everyone to list their address. We then got objections from the various people who don't list their address for various reasons, and so this gives a searchable way of doing it. You notice we put in the on page 111 and 112 of the amendment. We put in again the language by request, so that the filing officer doesn't have to look at every single one of them. You'd have to suspect for some reason that someone didn't live in the district before you would make that request. So it's not an automatic thing that gets done. But there's no more information or less information that's required right now. I mean, it's just required and can be required and kept secret.
President Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Kahn. And I do appreciate what you're doing here. In putting down the address, the candidate's residence address, I think will be a good administrative change and be helpful all the way around. I think, though, down on line 124, you already have exemptions there for judicial, those who we know have risk involved. Since you already have those exemptions down there, is it really necessary? Because legislative candidates, where they live and their addresses, are generally fairly well known anyway, and with the short time frame for filing, and especially with redistricting coming up, that's where this really, really gets to be hard. That, you know, classifying it as private data, I think since you have the exemption on the bottom, I don't know that maybe that's necessary.
Representative Kahn.
Have a comment on that?
That was believed, the senator who does this, who doesn't want her address listed publicly, did believe it was necessary. So I think the issue, you know, I don't think it's likely to come up often, but it seems to me we ought to have a solution. Joe, do you want to say anything about
Representative Poppy, further question,
okay.
Unless Representative Kitzmeier is... Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I'm just wondering about, since you have that it's classified as private data if the candidate prefers, why isn't that written that it's public data unless the candidate would indicate it? I'm just thinking about is there many things that are listed as public data, but then if you want to go the extra step, you'll request it to be private.
I think it's obvious that it is because you have to list it on the form for filing. It's listed on the form for filing unless you request it as private data. I think it's obvious then that that's public.
Representative Poppy?
It's obvious that it's, thank you, Mr. Chair, it's obvious that it's public or that it's private?
All right, Representative, let's go to Mr. Caring.
Okay.
Mr. Caring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, this is a default provision in data practices that says that everything's public unless it's classified otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't state here the classification of a residential address, it will be presumed public unless, under these provisions, the candidate specifically requests that it be classified as private.
Thank you. It seems as though it reads a little clumsy, and maybe it's just my reading of it.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, since that's the issue that will be dealt with in civil law.
Civil justice will probably take a look at that. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Kahn renews her motion that House File 655, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to civil justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Representative Johnson, I saw him here. There he is. Members, we had laid Representative Johnson's bill over at our last meeting to take a look at an amendment that would have given authority to not just the 19 or 20 groups that already had it and the Indian Affairs Council, but there have been at least two other groups that are coming up this session. So I'm going to move that House File 456 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register, and then I will move the DE1 amendment that will give that authority, its permissive language, to all of the various agencies. Representative Johnson has graciously consented to carry the bill rather than us having to have at least three or four this session and others. So let's discuss the DE1 amendment before we put it on the bill. If there's any discussion, members should have had enough time to take a look at it. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, is there a fiscal note that was requested?
Representative Emmer, we've also asked Finance if they want to take a look at this, and they have said no because it is permissive language. So they did not want the bill. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion to House File 456 is amended? Seeing none, anyone wish to testify? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 456, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
The last bill on the calendar is Representative Kalin's, House File 1010. And have we lost Representative Kalin? We've misplaced it.
Can you make that permanent?
Reflect action. Representative Kalin, you're up. President Kalin, there's no motion on your bill yet, so would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1010 be recommended to pass and referred to the Health and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee. Is that the appropriate motion? To the General Register, excuse me. Mr. Chair and members,
and Representative Kalin, there's one other matter that the chair would like you to take care of today that you failed in your last attempt, so before the committee.
I can't remember the stator of the phrase that that's looking after.
That's correct. And hopefully you'd remember what the phrase is.
I do remember the phrase.
All right. We'll see if you can succeed today. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. House File 1010 is follow-up to the 2008 Military and Overseas Voting Act, that is the result of years of collaboration between the Secretary of State Office and the Pentagon, the Department of Defense. You should have a letter dated January 3rd, 2007 in your packet. From then Deputy Director Scott Weidman of the Federal Voting Assistance Program. The 2008 Military and Overseas Voting Act resulted in increase in successful ballots from military and overseas voters of 420%. And you should have the UOCAVA statistics certification table also in your packet. The success rate of our uniformed service members in 2006 was just 19%, thanks to the transmission of email ballots and other provisions that made the process much more accessible, as well as, I think, a very aggressive effort on part of the Secretary of State's office working with the Overseas Vote Foundation to use technology and sort of outreach. That the success rate went from 19% to 61%, which I think this committee and this the legislature should be extremely proud of doing, and I'm proud to have been involved in that effort. House File 1010 addresses one provision that did not become law last year, as well as a couple of technical references now that we're allowing absentee ballot applications as well as the ballots to be emailed overseas. I just want to remind you that though the Pentagon wanted us to be able to have marked ballots be emailed back and printed out, we resisted that effort and do require that the actual hand of the voter, the pen, touch the ballot and that ballot be mailed back. And I think the recount has shown the importance of being able to go back to that original pen on paper.
Representative Kalin, what happened to this bill last year, our last session?
This provision or the...
Well, there was some controversy in the governor's office, wasn't there, over a provision in this bill?
I was just going to get to that provision, Mr. Chair. I think the provision that you see in Section 1 was... I think there were questions about what the provision actually did. I think it was just was a matter of education
and of also seeing that the process that we set up in the 2008 bill with the email transmission would work. And so I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Stirner, Representative Tiffmeyer, and others on this committee who are co-authoring this this bill. Section 1 is a request of the Pentagon and addresses United States citizens who are born overseas. We believe that the vast majority, in fact, I don't know that we've encountered anybody who doesn't fit the category of either being children of missionaries serving overseas or of the military family, but American citizens born overseas who stay overseas because of their parents become voting age. And in 32 states, including Minnesota currently, those citizens are disenfranchised because this provision isn't in law. You should have in your packet the list of 18 other states that do allow American citizens born abroad to vote in the state of their parents. That's all that this provision would do. It does say, I'll direct you to existing law, line 1.9, that this is the exclusive voting procedure for United States citizens, and also to existing law in line 1.15, that these citizens would only be able to vote in the offices of president, vice president, senator, and representative in Congress, so only federal races. That's the provision that was part of a compromise and deferred until this year. And
Rep.
I'd like to ask...
Rep. Kalin, has the governor then changed his mind on this provision and will sign the bill?
I don't think that we've had... I have not yet had communication with the governor's office about the status of their feelings about this provision. I do believe that because it's a Pentagon initiative, because it deals with only citizens, and because 18 other states, including fairly conservative states of Georgia and Nebraska and North Dakota and Oklahoma, that I'm optimistic, and the bipartisan support for the bill as well, as I'm optimistic that we will get this provision into law this year.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, you said there's been a compromise, but apparently you haven't talked to the governor. And if I recall right, last year this was a Pentagon initiative too. So I'm just wondering, who's the compromise with?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the agreement was to defer, and those are the words that I use, this section, as well as what I would say is an even more difficult provision to understand the consequences and draft correctly, and that was the emergency powers provision. I know Mr. Gehring and Mr. Shepard from House Research have been working on that provision. I'm not yet comfortable that we have a solution for that. I believe that was really the heart of the matter.
Representative Emmer.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's no compromise, Representative Kalin, when it comes to the language in Subdivision 1. Is that right?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I don't believe that I suggested that there was a compromise on this provision. What I suggested was that there was an agreement to defer the other two provisions, and that was the agreement that got the 2008 bill in law.
Right. Thanks. Sorry if I missed
that.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, how many people does this affect overseas? What's the number?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the extrapolating from the numbers that the Hennepin County Elections Office of Inquiries that they receive, which I believe are approximately two dozen every year, every election cycle, that this probably deals with about 150 citizens.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin. So we got 150 citizens. If they've got to meet the requirements for voting in Minnesota, regardless of the parent issue living here, that means they're all at least 18 years of age. Is that correct?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, yes.
All right, so Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, then at 18, even if their parents, one or both, are military personnel stationed overseas, or if their parents are missionaries, they've reached the age of majority. They can establish residence theoretically anywhere they want. Is that correct?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I think that they have a right to establish residence wherever they wish, but the reality is that these are American citizens who are disenfranchised from the right to vote because of the lack of this provision in law. The Pentagon has very clearly advocated for this provision because it strengthens the ties and the roles of American citizens as ambassadors for this country. And I think in a time of increasing globalization, this section is ever more important.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Representative Kalin. So are you telling me that they aren't required to remain overseas by someone else? I mean, this is it their free choice to remain overseas, or are they being required? Are they being held there?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, they are citizens of the United States who do not have a state in which to vote. That is actually the question here, is are we going to make sure that these citizens have a right to, are able to be enfranchised of their right to vote?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I thought my questions were, even though they're a little sharp, they're pretty straightforward. I think that people who remain overseas by their own choice determine whether they're available to vote or not, whether they've established a residence. I just have two more questions for you. The first is, how do you determine a permanent residence overseas? Because my understanding of military personnel or missionaries is that's something that's constantly moving, and really you're visiting, you're not permanently residing. And second, I'm interested to know how many of these 150 people are able to vote in local elections overseas in addition to having the right to potentially vote here in this country.
President Kalin, I want to defer that to the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chair, I'll address the second question. I think the first, Ms. Fraser can answer the permanent residency question. The question at hand is our statutes and the right to vote for American citizens. I'm not an expert in international election law and don't believe that that's the purview of this committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer. Yeah. Let's go to the Secretary of State's office. Welcome to the committee and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Fraser and I'm with the Office of the Secretary of State. To answer your question, Representative Emmer, about permanent residence outside the United States, I think that the federal government now uses the term indefinite instead of permanent. And so in our housekeeping bill, we're changing that language from permanent to indefinite. But I believe that that means that individuals don't have a time certain when they're planning to return. So if they don't know when they're planning on returning, then they would fall under this provision and be limited to voting in only federal elections. If they are overseas on a work assignment, in the military, or a student, then they have a time certain when they're returning, and they would be allowed under the previous subdivision of the statute to vote in local elections and state elections.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Fraser, but this bill doesn't change the term permanent to indefinite.
Representative Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Fraser, so when's that? Is that part of another bill that you're proposing? Or
Representative Emmer, there's the housekeeping bill that the Secretary of State has, and there are at least two or three other bills that the Secretary of State has introduced on a variety of election topics. But I believe Ms. Fraser did say that this reference was in their housekeeping bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I think that the word permanent, for the most part, applies to the individual's parent. I don't think it actually applies to the individuals that are affected by the new language in this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Frazier, so is it your testimony then that you don't even have to be a permanent resident or a indefinite resident of outside of this country in order to be able to vote under this bill?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, you would need to be a child of a United States citizen who last resided in Minnesota, who had never resided in the United States.
Is that a natural-born child or the a child by law?
Let's let one person at a time answer questions. Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, you have to be a United States citizen whose parents resided in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ms. Frazier, and I'm sorry that I'm getting gas from Representative Winkler. My question had to do with the definition of parent. Is that somebody's adoptive parent, or does it have to be natural parent?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, perhaps Mr. Gehring knows what the definition of parent is. I'm not familiar with the statutory definition.
Do you have some assistance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the language used in the bill just says parent, and there's not, as far as I know, a definition of parent in Minnesota election law.
Representative Kalin, you had one other person on the list to testify. Is that individual here today?
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel John Kingry is in the audience and
right.
is available to testify if we have any questions.
Did you want him to testify or not?
I think his testimony, he served in Kuwait and was the chief voting officer, I think, for his unit in Kuwait. I think it would be helpful just to hear from him for 30 seconds.
Since he's here, and welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Kimbry. I'm a Lieutenant Colonel of 214th Legal Support Organization, Army Reserve Organization, out at Fort Snelling last year. As you may have remembered, I think I testified in favor of the original bill last year and probably the other bill before that in 2007. And I know there was a lot of work done on the bill between 2007 and the one that was passed last year. I'm just, as Representative Kalin said, I think the situation in which this would happen is very rare, but it's not uncommon. It is rare, but there are situations where you have service members servicing in, you know, Germany, Japan, Korea. We still have very large bases overseas, and again, I think it's a fairly narrow change to the bill. But it's one that I would encourage you to vote. And it's something that in the military, there's a very robust voting registration program and encouragement to get service members to vote. And this would certainly be consistent with that.
Any questions? Mr. Kingman? No? Thank you. Further discussion to the bill. Anyone else wish to testify? Representative Kalin then renews his motion that House File 1010 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Poppy.
I move the minutes of Thursday, February 26, 2009.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Members, we have a rather lengthy agenda perhaps tomorrow, so let's be on time, and we have a bill that will take some work. With that, meeting is adjourned.